This episode brought to you by RX Bar. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/TRN and enter the promo code TRN at checkout. RX Bar is great for any occasion, including not only going to the trail, on the trail, but how about breakfast on the go, snack at the office, throw it in your bag on the plane, toss it in your backpack, or just give it to a friend and share the great 14 different delicious flavors. Have you ever tried mango pineapple or chocolate hazelnut, or how about chocolate chip peanut butter? Awesome stuff. And my all-time favorite, sea salt maple. Oh, it's good. RX Bar believes in full transparency and puts its ingredients right on the package. 3 egg whites, cashews, dates. It doesn't matter what they're putting in it. One thing they'll absolutely guarantee is there's no BS. How do we know that? It's right on the label. No artificial colors, sweeteners. It's gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free. I encourage you to get some RX bars. Just go to rxbar.com/TRN and enter the promo code TRN at checkout. Tailwind Nutrition. Scott, when I say Tailwind, what do you think?
I think of a sail pushing me down the trail.
Well, that would be trail sailing, but I'm talking about tailwind.
Trail sailing?
Yeah. One of the things that can take you out of a good training run or even a race is just mismanagement of your fuel, of your electrolytes, of your fluid. And Tailwind is like a crew in your bottle.
Do you remember the old commercials for Reese's peanut butter cups?
Yes, I do.
You put your peanut butter in my chocolate. Two very good things brought together to be even better. Well, Tailwind has taken three things. It's taken your hydration, it's taken your nutrition, and it's taken your electrolytes and put them all together in one so you don't need to think about it. It's in a smooth, savory taste.
And now they've even gone one step further, Scott. They have a recovery drink.
A recovery drink that you don't need to think about. You just shake, mix, and bam.
You've recovered.
Just that easy.
Head over to our partners page, click on their banner, and bang, you've got yourself some Tailwind.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest trail running nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right. We ready?
Yeah.
All right. All right. We ready?
Yeah.
My best French accent, because I'm a linguist.
You German? I don't know. I forgot who was doing the German accent last time, but that was a little bit so-so.
It was terrible.
It was Scott.
It was terrible.
But because I edit, and I would have edited it out. But since it made Scott look a little bit
foolish,
I kept it in.
Yeah. Anything to make fun of me. Jeez.
All right.
You kept it.
Yeah.
Are we ready?
Here it is. Okay. I'm ready. You ready? Okay.
Hit it.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Ward.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And we are jumping virtually across the pond. And not only a jump across the pond, but then a skip a little bit to the south to Hong Kong.
Well, this is like one of those skip, jump, leap, triple jump things.
It's a little bit of cross training.
Okay. We don't even know what that term is, Scott.
It helps with the springiness of your legs, sinew of your legs.
There's an actual event that does the hop, skip type jump into the...
It's called the triple jump.
Okay, that's what we're doing.
That's what we're doing. Let's get on with it. We're making a triple jump across the pond, and we are coming to us live from... Well, of course, we're recording this, so it's not live. It's live to me. From Hong Kong, we have a French expatriate, Romain. Let me see if I can do my French accent. Romain Blanchard.
Yes.
No.
Very good.
Very generous of you, Roman.
Roman Blanchard. And Roman is one of those guys that is maybe listened to at least 5 minutes of the podcast, mm-hmm. and he reached out to us with some stuff. And it was such good stuff that we decided, hey, he should be on a podcast.
Let me define stuff. He wrote an article, 13 things I learned or relearned in my last 120K ultra marathon. And that's a fun discussion because The 13 things he learned and relearned, we are learning and relearning ourselves, as well as all other listeners. Regardless of if you've run 120 Ks, you're still relearning some of the same lessons. So it'll be a fun discussion.
And Roman, tell us, first of all, how do you get as a Frenchman to Hong Kong, and what are you doing in Hong Kong?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the invite, guys. I'm really, really honored. Been listening to the show for like many years now, probably six years. And yeah, I just can't believe it. That I'm here, but anyway, what was your question again?
it was you're a Frenchman living in Hong Kong. That sounds like a Sting song. A Frenchman living in Hong Kong. Isn't that a Sting song?
It may be. I feel stung listening to that question. How did you make it to Hong Kong?
Basically, 8 years ago now, I met a beautiful Hong Kongese woman who is now my wife. And 5 years ago, we decided to move to Hong Kong together.
That's probably the best reason to move anywhere is to go there with your wife.
Exactly, yes. And then we've been there. Yeah.
How long have you been there?
5 years now.
Did you pick up ultra running in Hong Kong, or were you in France and already established in the sport and moved to Hong Kong hoping you'd find some trail? Which happened first? Hong Kong or the trail?
I was not established, but I already had a few go in Europe. My first ultra was in Brussels, and it was like 82 kilometers in the cross country of Brussels, and that was kept a good experience of it. It was raining for like 10 hours, and finished with like tons of blisters, and that was great.
And that hooked you?
That's perfect.
The that rain, me, yeah. Trails, and blisters. That's what I put on my list of fun things to do.
And Belgian beer.
And Belgian beer. There you go.
That helps with the rehab. So before we jump into the 13 things and compare notes, our personal notes against yours, and probably some of the listeners too, what do you think the first lesson you learned there from that 82K in Brussels? Maybe it didn't even make the list. Perhaps it did. We'll find out as we discuss them. But can you recall your first lesson pulled from that 82K?
The first lesson probably was like pacing myself.
Yeah.
But that's one lesson that I keep to every race. And the second lesson, I remember it was a guy who was wearing the wrong shoes and keep tripping and sliding.
Was that
wear
you?
The right No, that wasn't me. That was the second lesson. Just make sure you wear the right shoes, especially when it's raining and it's muddy.
Yeah, I heard of a guy. I knew a guy. Lee told me about him, Lee McKinley. A guy chose to wear, at Western States, for the first part of the run, cleats, soccer cleats.
Really?
For the first part of the run.
Was it raining or maybe it was a snow year?
I don't
year?
Even know, but there wasn't a soccer ball out there, so I don't know what he was wearing those for. Let's kick this thing off.
Yeah,
top 13 things.
First of all, how many 100Ks have you run up to this point? Because this is centered around 100K distance. It probably translates to other distances, but how many 100Ks had you runners? Was this the first one?
That I finished, I did 3 100K. And that I not finish was one. What I finished, I did 61, and I did a sad DNF.
Okay,
it was an happy moment on the second.
So let's jump.
Start with 13 or start with one? Which direction? Let's let Romain decide. Which are we going? 13 up, or are we going to go number one down?
You choose.
Let's
not
go
13, maybe. 13 is a little bit the hard one, but
okay. Let's start with number one then.
Let's start with number one.
What's your first lesson, Roman, and we'll discuss it?
Yeah, your number one expectation should always be to finish unless you want to get punched in the face. That comes from a famous quotation from a famous boxer, and he was saying everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. And basically, especially for a new distance, I do believe that you should come with only one goal if you don't want to put like extra weight inside your bag. Like, finish it. Like I did the Lavaredo like 2 weeks ago, which was like 120 kilometers, and it was only 20 kilometers, even 15 kilometers extra of like my biggest distance. But I felt like it was a bit of a gap. So I went with like a little bit, maybe a little bit too many goals, and I think just finish it, going there and saying just finish it would have been like definitely a good way to go.
I think that's a really good frame of mind to go into a new race like this, a new distance. And I couldn't agree with you more, because if you go in with the idea that I want to do this time or that time, and if by some crazy, you know, act of nature or whatever, you're not hitting those goals, all of a sudden you're disappointing yourself. The race isn't even over, and you're failing. Technically, you're not hitting the goals that you set, and I think that plays a little bit of a mind game on you, and you start feeling negative about yourself. But if you go in with the idea that, you know what, I'm going to finish this race under the cutoff time, and then that's your primary goal, I think that's a good thing to do.
Exactly.
I agree with both of you. I think positive mental attitude is the key to endurance. You have to stay positive, and if your goal is just to finish, then you just deal with whatever's coming at you. You make modifications. You adapt to that type of stress, and you're still okay because you're still on finish pace. But if you've got hard numbers on your bottle, written down this aid station this time and this aid station this time, you could get some negative chatter in your head and feel like you've kind of blown your race, when in fact, there are so many peaks and valleys in a race that there's no way, when you're sitting down with a Sharpie and your bottle and you're writing things down, you can predict those ebbs and flows. You just need to go out there and adapt and accommodate to whatever comes at you and enjoy it. So picking hard numbers may be a hard lesson to, and one that needs to be relearned. So
I think that there's some truth behind the physical part of that too. If you're coming up on an aid station and on your cutoff sheet says that you need to be there in 15 minutes and you have a very hard climb coming up and you push it, you could actually jeopardize your finish by just going out too strong and really messing things
Definitely.
Up. What do you think, Roman?
This is true, especially the downhill. You think you will save some time on the downhill by going a little bit faster than you're supposed to, but actually you will lose it towards the end. If I can add also, my watch was adding extra mileage. So when I was getting to a checkpoint, I was like not checking the exact distance, and I thought I was like kind of on time at some point towards the race. And then I realized that my watch was adding like 6 extra miles. So I thought I'm going to get there. I'm like, oh, it's 115 kilometers now. I'm almost there. And actually, you know, stupid enough to realize that my watch was just wrong.
You thought you were running in miles, but it was actually kilometers?
No. The watch was adding 10 kilometers.
Oh. And I
wanted to believe the watch. That was my mistake. That was another mistake. But I will learn from it next time, definitely.
Roman, have you ever tried running without a watch or racing without a watch?
My last, in January, I did the Hong Kong 100, and the watch shut down after 10 kilometers. And I did, I did a very good performance on that time.
Wow.
Going for it.
All right, let's move on.
Have you ever tried running a race without a watch, Freeman?
Oh, yeah.
Not because you forgot it, but intentionally.
No, only because it was unintentional, Scott. Either the battery died, it didn't charge, and I forgot it, but never intentional.
Okay. What's number two, Roman?
But the number two, excuse me one second. And the number two, come back to the number one. I wrote down a new distance is a new beginning for a new beginner. Meaning what? Read number one again, which is come back to the number one point. Especially, I'm glad I did 120K. So I moved 120K instead of like, let's say I will get through the lottery of the UTMB and I'm at the UTMB starting line. I can remember that, I got the 120K and I mean, there's a lot of things to learn. So it's nice to be patient. Especially for a lot of fellow ultra runners tend to jump sometimes to big distances. It's nice maybe to think about it and go progressively, because each new distance you become somebody who's just a beginner again.
I think
there's not even sport like this.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's in our community, there's a lot of people that have run shorter distances. Even marathoners have been spending a lot of time at marathon distances and become quite proficient at running marathons. And then they jump up into a longer distance. Maybe going from marathon to 50K is not that big of a distance, but going from a marathon to a 50-miler or a road marathon to
a trail marathon
is
completely different.
You become the newbie.
Yeah,
in the pack, right?
Or a different race with different climate, where it's hot, or there's a lot of climbing involved, elevation,
or like Arrowhead, lots of snow.
Yeah,
yeah. I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, that if you're trying a new distance or a new, let's say race profile, you need to check your ego at the door. All the experience that you have probably is going to help you, but you can't think that that's what's going to help you finish.
And I think the veteran ultra runner that's learned the lesson and relearned them goes out there to more run their body instead of their watch. You know, they're running what they feel, and they respond mm-hmm. to what's happening on the fly. And the watch is an additional piece of data that comes in. It's interesting, but doesn't dictate their day. Their body dictates their day, and they learn to listen very, very well. So you can we talk about new races, new beginnings. New aid stations could be new beginnings. New time, you know, there could be a lot of restarts, you know, if you can fabricate them. But the only way to restart, if I can just kind of go on a soapbox here for a second, the only way to restart is not let yourself get off that into the hole. You can't restart if you've destroyed yourself. You have to recognize that this isn't going well. I'm starting to fall off the tracks here. I better regroup early. Just pushing through and working hard isn't going to correct this. I need to make an adjustment, some real adjustments, some effort adjustments, some fuel adjustments, some adjustments. Otherwise, no matter how much will you have, and I'm subject to that. We talked about K2 repeats, and I predicted 36. Well, at 4, I was sleeping up top. I kind of fell apart. I needed to adjust some things early, and I didn't. I relearned that lesson, and that's a good one. That is a good one.
I think, Roman, and give me your opinion on this, do you think that you ever can consider yourself a ultra-running
veteran?
No. No, I do not want to think like that. First of all, like ultra running runner, for me, I just want to be a runner. So even if like AJW one time, he said that if he can go running 3 miles a day for the rest of his life, I thought was one of the most inspiring things ever, because at the end, it's like, you just want to run, like, even if it's like a little bit every day. So, I mean, ultra distance is amazing because you can reflect on it for like weeks and months, but I go to a 20K race and I'm happy too.
Yeah, that's good. I think number 3 is going to resonate with my friend Don across the table here. Roman, tell us what number 3 is.
The number 3 was mindfulness. And I was explaining that basically the first half, I tried to keep things mindful and like being aware and like keep my mind still, not like get involved with like too many thinking. But even if I was pushing a little bit too hard for the pace I should have gotten. But it helped a lot towards the end, I thought. I thought at the end, like, because even if I went through quite a bit of pain, my quads went down because of the downhill, that, like, the mind stayed pretty strong. And once I reflect on it, I thought it's because those first, like, 50 kilometers, I really stayed, like, really mindful and aware of, like, what was going on in the race, in my body, and that helped a lot.
How do you do that? How do you stay mindful? Do you have any techniques?
I got a bit. One of the tricks would be like when you talk to yourself, you can say like, "I'm mindfully aware that I don't know something's going on." Like you start your sentences, but that sounds like a little bit extreme. Or one thing that you that I do is just like I don't get overwhelmed and I don't get underwhelmed. So if I'm feeling great, I'm not going to say, oh, it's amazing, I'm feeling so good. Or if I'm feeling bad, I always keep it to, I am fine or I am okay. And it paid off a lot. And sometimes we get like really overwhelmed, we start like feeling great and we're going up that hill and we're just like, this is awesome. And that's a mistake we can make. Or sometimes we think like really like not good, and we just like, instead of like always like pulling back to like, I'm just fine, I'm okay, it works out most of the time.
Yeah, Robin, I think I agree with that comment. Mindfulness is paying attention to yourself as you're going down the trail. And when things are going right, you still need to be thinking just as if they're going wrong. Why is it going right? What do I need to do to keep this right? Just because things are feeling perfect, you still need to be in a crisis mode. You still need to be thinking, what do I need to do to keep this perfect? Because as soon as I fall off this track that I'm on, this perfect spot, it's going to be tough. So you've got to be paying and engaged and making adjustments just as you are when things are awful. When things are good, you need to be just as involved.
I think that's real. I don't know whether I ever thought of that before. That you can learn.
You taught me that.
That you can. I did.
Yeah.
that you can learn from the things that are going well. If things are going well, don't just sing a song and skip happily down the trail.
Waiting for something to go bad.
Why are things going so well? How come I'm feeling so strong? And do an inventory of everything that, you know, your body, your nutrition, your hydration, and see what's going right. I like that, Don.
Yeah. Mindfulness is important when things are going right and when things are going poorly.
And Roman, I want to touch on something that you said too, that sometimes keeping a positive mental attitude helps you to get in that mind or keep in that mindful state. If you're complaining and thinking about things and just really being a negative person when things are going wrong, you can't be mindful. That's a distraction.
Mm.
When you're
complaining in your own mind, you lose the opportunity to solve a problem because you're too busy complaining.
I'm reading a book right now that says that you cannot multitask. You can't focus on two things at the same time. So if you're concentrating on this hurts and I have my feet and I'm thirsty, you can't focus on how is my body doing? How is my heart rate? How is my effort level? That sort of thing. Yeah. I think that's a very good point. Thank you, Roman, for bringing that up.
Hey, Roman, number four. I'm going to read number four for you, and then you can comment on it. Here's what you put. When you think you have nothing left, you can still put one foot in front of the other or one pole in front of the other. Have you been to that point where all you have left is just one more step?
I want to ask the question in a different way, and probably in a better way than Don did.
Of course. I just read his verbatim. I don't think you insulted me. You insulted our guest.
Roman, you put that on the list because something happened out there.
Oh, that's much better, Scott. Yeah.
Something happened. Like, basically, the downhill killed my legs. My legs were like two pieces of wood, you know? Like hard wood. You've been to that state.
Oh, yeah.
And what else are you going to do? You've been planning the whole trip about going to do a bit of a tourism and like at the end finish with the race. So you just can't just say, okay, enough is enough. I mean, you just got to find a way to just to carry on towards the end. And yeah, I thought about it. Just put one foot in front of the other. After I change it to like, maybe you can put one pole because when the legs are like suffering that much, the poles like definitely help. Especially when the downhill is the killer. I mean, it's just like, that becomes like, because like, you can't just force it. You know, it's like your body weight is going down and like, each step is like a little bit of pain. You know? And like the Lavaredo finished with 10 kilometers downhill. So it's just it's quite intense at the end.
Hey, Roman, we're talking about, if I remember right, this is the North Face 120K in Hong Kong?
Yes.
Tell
in
us
in Italy, Cortina d'Ampezzo.
Oh, okay. This wasn't in Hong Kong. This was an Italy race, Italian race.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Tell
us a little bit about that race. What kind of a race is it? What is the topography? What kind of race is it?
Yeah, 120 kilometers in the beautiful Dolomites, Italy. It's a world stage tour of ultra trail, so it's a massive reunion of like the trail running community. A lot of professionals showing up, And there's three different races. That is in 120 kilometers, and there's one 48 kilometers that Zach Miller won, and then there's a 120 kilometers. For the elevation, we're talking about 6,000 meters of vertical, and also the highest that you reach is 2,500 meters elevation. So yeah, it's quite intense.
Very mountainous.
Like the terrain, mountainous, technical, and the downhill are like really long.
Here's the next one. I'm reading them, Scott, until you approve of my actual interpretation of the question. Keeping in mind, I'm reading number five.
Yeah.
And a good one. I think this is a veteran move here. If there's ever a veteran move, it's this one. And then Roman, you're up to help validate it, hopefully before Scott makes a comment on my on my question. It's okay to walk first. My friend, which has tons more races experience than me, walked a lot in the first 30K. He finished 7 hours before me. So, yes. So a guy walks first, and he's out there and lets the group move ahead, and you look behind him like, what's wrong with my friend? Next thing you know, he's got 7 hours of chair time before you get to the finish line.
Yeah, it's true, yes. I thought about that a lot, actually. Because he did finish in like 18 hours, and I took like 25. And I remember he said, "You start a little bit too fast, especially in the downhill. Take a little bit of your time." And I mean, if we go running for 10 kilometers, like the first kilometers, or maybe the first 2 kilometers, we're still gonna go a little bit slow. And in ultra running, we tend to forget that. We see a downhill, we go a little bit faster. We shoot. So it's quite important that you get your body to acclimate the terrain, especially when you're in a new country, new trail, like you haven't experienced before. So it's nice probably to think that the first like 15-20% of the race, you should just get a little bit of a rest and make your body to get a sort of a starter of the whole meal.
Let me ask you, this friend that bested you by 7 hours, is he somebody you trained with? Was he a training partner?
Yeah, I trained with him, but he's got way more experience than me. But when it comes to like race pacing, of course, and he's done the race before, so that helps. So he knew a little bit more, but he gave me a few advices, which I should have noticed a little bit more. But he did.
So when you're out there training with them, are there times that you guys are both running together, you're both tired about the same time, you're both happy that you're back to the trailhead where your car is at? Do you notice that you're pretty compatible in your training days, yet a race day, because of his experience and his execution, there was a huge separation? I imagine if you go out on a training run, he doesn't finish 3 hours before you. I imagine you guys are both tired at the end. You've had good workouts. He just executed on race day differently. That's my point. Do you think, am I making up something, or maybe there's a hint of truth there?
I mean, the execution, thing I look back is like the big downside for me in the race was the execution, and definitely execution and strategic execution for those long distance races is what experience is made of.
You know,
you can't. Yeah.
Here's what I think would be very interesting. You get a sheet of paper, right? And maybe before the race, you write down how you plan to execute. After the race, here's what I actually did, and here's what happened. And look at the two and say, would I ever plan on doing what I did? I had a good plan. I understood the rules. Yet when I actually raced it, I did these bonehead moves that I would never do in preparation as a strategy, as a plan.
It would be nice to put timestamps on there to find out when you actually fell off the planned part and went with what was actually happened.
Yeah, mine would be the morning before the gun went off when I was sitting in the outhouse because of the meal I had the night before. I mean, my planning fell apart before the race even started.
It happens a lot, actually.
Okay. So you say you learned this from the last race. Do you have any plans to change? I mean, what's coming up for you? Are you going to walk the first quarter of the race?
No, but I'd be more careful, definitely on technical terrain, and I will know that my legs are not like bulletproof if speed them down the first 20 miles. So,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, the whole warm up, like, yeah, I know it's like, sounds not right to say we need to warm up, but I think like the first, like 15% should be considered as a bit of a warm up and understand how is the terrain and how much it can affect your race.
Number seven.
I'll read number seven if I can get there. Scenery is.
No, that's number six. Then we're on six.
We're on six. Well,
I'm sorry.
Pay attention to the numbers, Freeman. Downhill is the traitor, but do not worry. I will get you next time. I love that one.
So traitor meaning the enemy, right? Downhill is exactly, the enemy of the traitor.
What did you mean by that?
I don't know. I started the race. I thought we were going to be friends. You know, downhill and myself. And then towards the end, I just couldn't take it. If I was seeing a hill or some trail that we needed to climb, I was just, like, happy. But the downhill, my quads were like just shut down and pain. And but when I said I will get you next time, I definitely understood what I did wrong, because I trained a lot of vertical climb and. The downhill, I was just pretty much during my training, taking my time. But I think when you train, you know that your heart rate when you're going downhill is like quite low. You should keep it up a little bit, not too high, but you should like speed up the process of going downhill. It will help a lot during the race. And that's what a mistake I made during my training. I was going way too slow during my downhill training. So now I understand what I did wrong also.
You know, we often talk about managing effort with heart rate. And I think it's wise for flats or uphills, but not downhills, because your heart rate's kind of been coasting in a neutral going downhill. But if you're trying to keep your heart rate up a bit, that's when you really hammer quadriceps and you shove your foot in the front of that shoe, and that's where blistering can occur. So just running completely in fast mode going downhill, letting the heart rate rise up because, hey, I can handle it. My heart rate's in a good spot. You still end up really abusing other parts besides the cardiovascular system. You start abusing the brakes, which sometimes is the front of your feet. It's the front of your quads. And then you end up with some real pain and dysfunction that you have to work through on the rest of your race. You would think that downhill is your real friend.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, at the end of a race, the uphill is a bit more comforting than a downhill. Man. Scott, I started to interrupt you.
I was going to say, you know, Roman, I had a question on your prescription for future races. So you said you trained running downhill at a slower pace. And
yes, I did.
And when you got to the race, you ran them faster, and that destroyed your quads. So your prescription is train running those downhills faster, and that should help translate into more successful race day. There's also an opposite thing there. Maybe if you're training running downhill at a slow pace, you should race the race running downhill at a slow pace.
Exactly.
So there's two ways to attack it.
No, it's true.
Well, yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, if you want to.
Did that confuse you?
No. If you want to. Here's what I got out of it. If you want to finish with a slow time, run slower. If you want to finish running a faster time, run faster and train faster. Is that how it works? That's how it works.
Yeah. Okay, so if you want to run faster time, if you want to have a fast time, run faster.
Yeah,
okay.
It's pretty that simple.
Is that on your list here somewhere, Roman, if you want to finish with a
second
fast
edition?
Time?
It's on the 14 things you learn from training.
Yeah.
Okay, Scott, number seven.
Number seven. This is the one I like. Scenery is your painkiller. Stop. Look up, look down, and look around. Embrace it. Beautiful.
Mm. Yes.
How is it your painkiller, Roman?
I mean, the Dolomites in Italy is just some of the most beautiful scenery ever. Very special. A little bit brutal, but it's like the view is. And then sometimes you get in the middle of like different cliffs, and you just have to look like really around everywhere. And it has that. I mean, sometimes like we think about the race, and we think about time and think about like how we're going to finish, but it's nice just to take like 2 minutes, and it's like, especially you're in pain, it's not going to change your performance, but it does going to help a lot sometimes, like, because you're never going to get back there unless you go and do the race again. You're never going to get back where you were. So you might as well enjoy it a little bit.
Yeah, there's some views that only people that have worked for them get to appreciate and enjoy. It's, you're talking about the Dolomites. There are certainly some places, as you view, there are not cars that are stopping and taking in the same views you are. You ran 60K to get to that view. And so it's a rare club that gets to take in what you get to look at. So it's nice to be part of that club.
Definitely.
All right. You've run some places. What do you think? What are some of the most beautiful mountains that you've had a chance to run in?
I myself, I thought like the Dolomites, because most of my own road here, I've done it in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is beautiful, I have to say, but like the Dolomites and the fact that you're going from one cliff to another, and sometimes you really have a circus of cliff all around you, and you are in the middle of nothing. And I mean, you realize you're nothing at the end when you look at the whole scenery, and it was quite amazing. Definitely. I thought it was like, it's a paradise for hiker. Even if I was like, I was going there for a hike, it's some of the best places in the world.
Yeah. I want you to read the next one, Roman. This is number eight.
Oh, that one, I don't know. Yeah, make sure you leave the checkpoint with your own pole. Hashtag long story.
I want to hear the story behind this one.
I want my poles back.
You know how poles are, like, you know how light they are. So
yes.
Basically, I get to a checkpoint when the drug bag was in, and I change shirt, have some food, and I'm ready to go, you know? And I just leave, you know? And I leave, and maybe like half a mile after, I'm like, okay, I'm going to start using my poles again. And I looked in my hand, because I was carrying my poles in like one hand. I looked in my hand, I had two sets of poles.
Oh.
I had my poles and somebody else's poles.
Oh, no.
I was like, oh, God. So I went back. I mean, I had to go back. I mean, I went back and I gave it back to the organizer, because God knows where I picked them up exactly, because I kind of changed and I had some food. But I'm sure if there's someone listening that, I'm sorry, I haven't done it on purpose.
So you didn't find the owner of the extra set of poles?
I just gave it to one organizer. It was like that big checkpoint where everybody's getting changed, getting their drop bags, and maybe you should cut this from the recording.
I got to hand it to you. You turned around and ran some extra distance to take him back. That's true Trail Nation etiquette.
Now, Roman, I'm going to ease your conscience a little bit. Number one, they weren't my poles, so you don't have to apologize to me. But two, as you were running back, I'm certain you looked to see if there was a poleless runner. You may have asked, hey, I think I have your poles. So nobody claimed them as you were coming back. You get to this big aid station. Apparently, that person probably hadn't left yet.
Yeah, that's true.
I imagine they finished that race with their poles. So well done. Good on you for not just... Me, I probably would have just hung him in a tree so people
laid him across the trail.
I would have put a little message out there on him. So you're a better man than I am. All right.
Okay, Freeman, number nine. You read number nine.
Don't be a foodie. Don't be picky and enjoy the soup. And that is honestly probably one of my biggest concerns. Not that I'm a foodie, but I'm going over to Europe to run Tour de Jeans, and I'm a little bit apprehensive about aid station food because I don't know how my stomach's going to deal with it. I'm adapted to potato chips, Oreo cookies. I know I can get down the trail on that. But I'm hearing about salami and cheese and some pasta stuff and things people bake and bring, and I'm just a little bit nervous. I'm not afraid to eat it that it's going to kill me, because I've got runners ahead of me that aren't falling over. But I just don't know what's going to happen to my stomach. So that's my concern. But let's hear what your thoughts are on number nine. Don't be a foodie.
Myself, I'm in the F&B business. So I've been making the mistake since I'm doing long distance to just comparing different checkpoint station, food offering. And when I talk to more professional runners, they don't seem to pay attention whatsoever. They have their system and they're like, no one really says like, oh, this is was really bad. So I think I was like always a little bit left alone. So now I'm just kind of understanding their point. You know, it's like, you gotta adapt yourself, you know. And one of the points was like, those checkpoints didn't have coffees. And I was like fixated about the fact that they have coffee when I should have just moved on. But yeah, I mean, I learned from it. And the soup, I mean, the soup is like, when you get to like those high cliff on high altitude, I mean, the soup is just settling your stomach. It does like so many good things. Even if you have a lot of runners at the queuing online, I think it's worth the queue, definitely.
Hmm. You know, I wonder if that's a international truth that soup in running ultras is always good, regardless of what country, regardless of what race you're running. If there's soup at the aid station, that's good stuff.
Go for it.
I don't know whether I've ever had bad soup at an aid station.
Fish head soup?
Fish head soup. Protein. You got a little protein there.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask what kind of soup it is. I'm going to just, it's soup, and I'm going to drink it, and I'm going to like it.
Roman, tell me this. What is your personal rule if you come up to an aid station and they have something that you have never trained with out on the aid station table and you think, that looks good? Do you take it or do you skip it?
I usually take it.
I mean, I like this guy.
Good, I mean...
Wait, he steals poles. You like the guy that steals poles, Scott?
I like guys that return poles, Freeman.
Oh, right.
So you're the kind of guy, you listen to your body so intently that when you get to the aid station, you say, that looks good, I'm eating it. I don't care whether I've never had it before.
What are they going to offer? What is the extreme that they're going to offer that we would say, maybe not? I don't know. Usually it's like, it comes back to the same. I mean, soup, salami, jam, Nutella. We have Nutella in Europe. No peanut butter. But, what would they serve?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they'd have to haul you out, and they're not. They've got enough stuff to haul out of an aid station, so they're going to keep you and sustain you, so you can move on to the next aid station where they might dump you off.
Yeah.
All right. Number 10.
I want to read number 10.
Go.
And my first question, even before I read this, I want to know if this is your words, because this is very well written. There's no competition or competitors, we are all comrades united by pain and sweat.
Yeah, that's good.
I like that. Yeah. Did you write that?
I wrote that.
That's very good.
And nothing is copy paste. I mean, the pain and sweat, if I can say, the pain and sweat, it comes from Theodore Roosevelt's speech, which is called "It's not the critic who counts." And I always think like this is matching. If anyone can read that and going through ultra running and remember that speech, which is like one page. It's not from it, but the pain and the sweat. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you read it, but
Scott will link it to the show notes. Theodore Roosevelt.
What was the speech called?
It's called "It is not the critic who counts."
Okay.
And it's a very inspired speech. That's where I got the pain and sweat, and the pain, sweat, and blood. But the competition and the competitor and the comrades comes from, like, I am a meat pack guy, and I realize that. I mean, when we're going through lows, you always got, like, some guys or stranger that's going to be in the height, and you can, like, hold to them and like have a quick chat, and they're always gonna show some support in somehow, which is like one of the beautiful things about the sport.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of that. Not that any of us need one, because we either done it or witnessed it, but one that I really appreciated was Jimmy Dean Freeman, and we were out there running AC, and we were moving along pretty good.
AC?
At AC.
Angeles Crest, 100 mile. Okay.
And we were halfway through and on a tough, tough section in the heat of the day, and we were making pretty good time. And when you're making good time, you like to continue to roll forward. There was a comrade, a fellow runner, that was not doing so well, that was taking a little break on the side of the trail. And Jimmy did not worry about time nor his position or anything, just stopped, opened his heart up, opened his hydration pack up, whatever that runner needed to get back on his feet. And I just observe that as just the right type attitude to have, and the type of runners that we come across or we are out there on the trail. So great example from Jimmy Dean on that. I'm sure it's that way on every trail in every place. That's what makes the community so great. Number 11. Number 11. Your training should acclimate yourself to not only the distance and elevation, but also the terrain. You need to do your homework. Damn those small rocks.
Yes, true, yeah.
So training on conditions that are similar to race conditions.
Exactly, yeah. When I train, I had a small bit of injury, so I didn't do enough trail during my training. And then once I realized that the trail also in Italy was slightly different, a lot of rocks, a lot of like tiny rocks of like small diameters. And on your articulation, I mean, it plays a lot like crazy. So I could have done like a little bit more trails and like just push it through definitely, because it's just instead of just focusing on like verticals. But yeah, when you train, it's like stupid enough. But when you train for a trail race, if you don't do enough trail, you will feel it. That's for sure.
It's so important to match your training conditions to your race conditions. If you're running in a cool environment with a lot of technical terrain, it would be unwise to run on a road that is, you know, out in the heat. So it's really critical to match those two. And you can be in shape. You can be in great shape. But if you haven't matched your training, you'll be surprised at how out of shape that you feel. What, he's playing a game over there, Scott? How come you're? No, what do you got going on, buddy?
No. I'm making notes.
Okay. Oh, good. Good. That's probably a good time to talk about show notes. Oh yeah, you've got Theodore Roosevelt. That's good.
Yeah, I got to do some of this stuff and right. Make sure the show notes are top shelf.
They are. And if you haven't ever read Scott's show notes, I encourage someone to do it.
Let's move on to a more important subject here. Okay. Number 12. This too shall pass. That's something that most ultra runners probably iterate in between their teeth at most parts during the run. This too shall pass, no matter how much pain or hell time in a quarter of a second. In a quarter of a second while passing the finish line, only goods will be kept.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. Let's separate some of those sentences and talk about them, because there's a couple of thoughts in there. Here's what I think. I think that Romans was getting towards 13, and so he shoved a bunch in 12. There's a good three in there. Bad things do get better, and they can get better if you practice the things that you've learned along the way. They get better if you believe they can get better too. There's been a lot of times you bounce right out of a race, both mentally or physically, because you just lose hope that things will get better. And things, it's very possible for them to get better only if you execute, only if you recognize them early. Because I said earlier in this podcast, you can bury yourself so deep that this too shall pass may take 2 days. And most races aren't 2 days. So, yes, this too shall pass in 2 days is a subtitle to that line. You've got to recognize early so that the things that are going to pass can pass in 2 hours and not 2 days. So an early observer, an experienced runner, will see the problem coming up early and make adjustments so that too shall pass. You're right. Everything passes. 2 hours is better than 2 days.
What did you mean, Roman, by the second part of that? In a quarter second while passing the finish line, only the goods will be kept.
Oh, I like it.
What do you mean?
It is true. It's magical when you think about it. You pass the finish line and everything's gone. You did your job. You did not. You finished the race. I mean, the pain you went through and like all those like times when you're like going for like 2 kilometers an hour, you forgot about it, and just like this, you just passed that line and it's gone, and all the memories comes back as good, the confidence is off the roof, and that's it. That's what we do it for, and that's why like DNF is like it's such a tough one, because you forget that I mean, you just finished the race and it will go through. You will go, and you will be rewarded, definitely.
You know, Roman, I couldn't agree with you more. And when you talk, and I thought about my finishes and finishes that I've witnessed and watched, and we've been lucky enough to announce some races, Scott, where we've seen a lot of finishers come through. And for myself and for the people that I've observed, there is a point of elation, of just happiness and joy that, you know, there was some struggle coming before that finish line, but in a quarter of a second when they pass, it is all lifted off of them, and there's nothing but reward that just pours on you from that at that moment at that finish line. You couldn't have described that better, and I hadn't really thought of it in that context, that everything is just lifted instantly, and it's just joy and satisfaction that you get to experience.
I think that they've done some scientific studies, and maybe I've even read some, but I can't remember them. But I think it's an
you making something up.
I think it's I'm going to make something up now. I think it's a very interesting phenomenon that we as humans forget the pain. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of a woman giving childbirth.
Right.
They forget about that soon after.
Any woman that has more than one child.
They forgot about it.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant.
Right.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm thinking back some of my races, and I think about one time, one of the races where I got sick to my stomach. I think I threw up a bunch of times, but I can't remember those. I know that I threw up and I was sick, but I can't remember how miserable it was. So I think that's an interesting phenomenon. That we forget the bad, we keep the good, like mm-hmm. Roman said.
Yeah. I like it. That's the only reason we sign up for another race.
Exactly.
But to your point, Roman, and you can certainly expand on this, the DNF that you referred to, mm-hmm. you are not instantly relieved of anything at a DNF. And I've been there where you fall apart. It's not like the finish line quarter of a second of joy and all the ugliness goes away. It just stays with you until you correct it.
Boy, that's a good point.
Yeah.
There's something magical about that arch, isn't there?
But a do not finish, you are pretty much beating yourself up for an extended period of time. There isn't a quarter second lift. There's a quarter second hammering that just is consistent.
I never thought of that. I have a DNF on my record. And I can't think of anything good about that race. Yeah. Not one thing.
Right. Had you finished, though? Yeah,
have I finished? I would have forgot all that.
All of that junk.
Ooh. Exactly.
We need to get some psychologists on this and do some studies.
Well, there's a study, Scott.
I'm sure there is. I'll Google that.
Yeah. All right. Number 13 belongs to you, Roman. Take us home. Take us home.
Number 13 was like, be humble. Yeah, that's a long one. But to look at it, there's many ways to see it. I mean, it has to be some of the hardest sport ever when we look at it. So if we show up with that ego, it's going to be your enemy. So you always need to show up with like a decent amount of humility, because anything is going to get you, either the talent, either the elevation, either the distance or the weather, or you're going to get cold. Something's going to happen that the nature would put you back in your place, pretty much. So, and then second thing also, I was thinking that we do have like one living legend for me in the sport, and it's Kilian. And he's got to be the most humble person. So if this guy is like the way he is, I mean, the whole community can be the same too.
Do you think that this is kind of chicken or the egg thing? Do you think that the trail humbles, or do humble people, are they attracted to trails?
Oh, I'll just jump in and say I think that the trail humbles people, but I think humble people also come to the trail. So
you didn't answer my question. You're basically saying both.
Yes, I'm saying both.
You're not taking a side.
Well, I'm going to expand on that. Had you let me finish my sentence?
Okay.
There. The trail works wonders.
Oh.
For some, it needs to humble. And for some, it just embraces the humble people. It welcomes the humble. Mm. I think in the end, everyone that passes through that finish line has a bit more humility as a result. And whether they started the race with it or whether they adapted to it along the way, it's a piece of magic that does happen. Another piece of quarter second magic. You're never, ever going to be bigger than a mountain, ever.
Ooh, that's deep.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's deep.
The hills always have the last word.
And hopefully the downhills will become your friend, Roman.
Exactly.
The downhills.
You need to practice more.
Hey, Freeman, is the Tour de Jeanne, is that running the Dolomites?
It's too early to do my research, Scott.
do you know, Roman, is the Tour de Jeanne in Italy, does that run through the Dolomites?
I don't know exactly, but almost 300 kilometers, it's got to run somewhere nearby.
There's not that much area in Italy, so it's got to run through the Dolomites.
We should be able to see the Dolomites from one of the peaks. I know there's five mountains that we go over, and so maybe maybe it's one of them.
So the reason why I bring that up is we have an expert now of the Dolomites. Roman, what kind of advice would you give to Don here, who's going to be climbing those mountains here in September?
I ran a little bit. I ran a hike a little bit during the race with someone who did the Tour de Géant. And, I mean, he had, like, some crazy mental because he had a swollen ankle. Is one of his heel of the shoe was, like, completely torn. And he was just going for it, like, not saying anything. And then I talked to him a little bit about it, and he said, oh, you know, if you can plan your sleep and try to stick to your sleep planning, that would help definitely for the Tour de Géant. I mean, you got to be humble with your sleep tank, definitely. You need to say, I need that amount of sleep, and it's going to make a big difference.
You know, I think we can apply all of your 13 lessons to any race that we go to. There isn't one that's extra in there. 13 is kind of a cool number. But we need all 13 things and practice them and learn them and relearn them along the way.
I think that's one of the cool things is the title of this article that you wrote, which will be linked in the show notes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Things you have learned and relearned. Mm. I wonder if we finally at some point get it. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I thought about it. I say, even if you're like some type of Highlander who lives for like 500 years and you carry on for, you still be learning something.
Yeah, it's a very complex subject, and it's one that's wonderful to study. And I'm happy to be a student with you, Roman, in this journey. So thank you for scribing them down, all 13 of them. Great reminders for me.
Thank you very much.
I've learned each one of the lessons before and and have had to relearn and plan to relearn a few again.
Yeah, yeah. What's next on your schedule? Do you have any other races this year?
Hong Kong season, the amazing racing in Hong Kong. Like, really, there's racing now, but it's really hot. But the season pretty much start again in October. And I plan my season to do smaller races and try to get a little bit more speed while I'm still being young. So I got some races, 50 miler, and I'd like to be able to race them a little bit more aggressively. But let's see how it goes. We never know.
Good. Well, it's going to be exciting to watch, to follow. Go out and do you have anything else to say, Scott?
Nope. I was going to say Moss.
Oh,
but
good.
You need to say run first.
Go out and run.
Mass.
Mass.